dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I am going to be escorting you about what I call the war for the free world. It is about ideas in part, but it is also about people taking action. And we're going to be speaking with people who are doing both. Angie McCrary of a terrific charitable organization known as the Semper Fi Fund is going to be joining us to talk about its mission, its work, and how you can help. Segment two, we'll be talking with the world-class scholar and expert on the Middle East, Waleed Fares, about major developments in his area of the world and what it might mean for us here in the United States. Segment three, we'll be talking with Colonel Ed Waldby about a major force multiplier for America, the Global Hawk, and how it is changing the battlefield and actually having civilian applications as well. And finally, Bill Gertz will join us with his week wrap-up inside the ring. We'll be visiting with Bill about what is going on at the moment inside the Pentagon, in China, and elsewhere around the world that needs our attention. So all of that straight ahead. But first up, I'm very pleased to say we have Angie McCrary, who is in charge of outreach at the Semper Fi Fund. And Angie, we speak to you on a day when thousands of bikers are commemorating the losses on 9/11 by riding from Somerset, Pennsylvania through Washington, D.C. on up to Ground Zero. And it calls to mind not only the horrors of that day, but also the tremendous work that people like you and the Semper Fi Fund are doing to try to not simply commemorate those who lost their lives then, but to help in enriching the lives of those who have sacrificed greatly for all of us in the years since. So welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for the work you're doing at Semper Fi Fund. And tell us a little bit about that work, if you would.
Sure. Well, the Semper Fi Fund was started by Marine Spouses back in 2004, a couple of years after 9/11. And our founder, Karen Gunther, saw the firsthand needs of those coming into our military hospital. She was a military nurse at Camp Pendleton in California and a Marine spouse. And she rallied her forces and friends, and she started a nonprofit. And over the last 7 years, we've been providing financial assistance, just immediate financial assistance for our injured service members and their families. And what this looks like on a daily basis is we provide grants to our injured and critically ill Marines and sailors, as well as their families, to help with their quality of life and help provide them with assistance as their needs progress.
And to qualify for this assistance, you need not be Marine, I take it. You are making it available, as you say, to members of other uniformed services as well who've been harmed in their line of duty. Is that right?
Yes, you have to be a Marine and or a sailor who was injured or is critically ill after 9/11, and or you have to be an Army soldier or Air Force Airman or Coast Guardman that was supporting Marine forces and also injured.
Got it. Okay. And in terms of the kind of help that you're providing, Angie McCrary at Semper Fi Fund, how can people help you help these individuals do the kind of rehabilitation and life-enriching work that that you're engaged in?
Well, it comes in many different forms, if I understand your question right. We provide everything from keeping family members at their bedside to providing assistance with the purchase of adaptive vehicles and adapting homes to transition support. We also have a sports program called Team Semper Fi that we love. It gets the guys and the gals engaged in sports and we partner with Paralympics on that, and they're provided world-class training and coaching, and we send them across the country to different sports events. It keeps them engaged mentally and physically.
Yeah, that's just so important. And I know this weekend up in Wisconsin, there is a race dedicated to the memory of Private First Class Ryan Jerebeck, with which you are partnering. Tell us a bit about that race. How do people qualify for it, and what are they doing apart from being obviously engaged this way? What do you find it does for these wounded personnel to help with their rehabilitation?
Well, like events like the Jerebeck Challenge, it's a community event. He was tragically killed in war, and his family is remembering him by hosting this run, and it brings the community out to show support and honor his service, as well as bring in much-needed support for injured service members. And it's events like these that we love because it draws in so many people, and we're able to educate them about the long-term needs of our wounded. When service members are wounded, if it's an amputation or a burn, it's pretty much a lifelong need of support, and we want to be there for them.
And to what extent do you actually enjoy support from the military or the government in any of this? Is it entirely private sector, and are you therefore entirely dependent upon charitable contributions to make this go?
Yes, we are a public nonprofit. We do not rely on government support. All our support comes from very patriotic citizens and corporations across the country. They keep us going, and we're very thankful for their support.
Yeah, and give us a sense of what kind of material support that translates into, because I'd like people listening to us here at Secure Freedom Radio, Angie McCrary, to understand what they can do to actually help these incredible young men and women, you know, enjoy as full lives as they possibly can. Is it simply financial contributions? You mentioned corporate sponsorship and support. What all can people do to help with this mission?
Well, of course, financial support is key to keeping us going. There are different ways you can do that. You can do a direct donation through our website, or you can go to our website and check out our donation page for other ways you can help. You can host an event like the Jerebeck Challenge, or it can be an office party, or, you know, dress down day in jeans. Or another big support for us is the combined federal campaign, where federal personnel and military people choose us as their charity of choice for the CFC. We are listed there. We are, or, you know, support from a large corporation would be huge. So that's another opportunity.
Just to give, again, to put a fine point on this, what you do is enable these men and women to have a second chance at life, really, and supporting their families and ensuring that they know that they are being sort of sustained by a grateful nation. And I guess give us your website at Semper Fi Fund, Angie McCrary, and make sure that we understand what specifically this means in terms of the viability of your programs if you don't get this support.
Well, if we don't get support, that's a challenge to us. We're military spouses. We have over 100 military spouses, Marine spouses, and we're always looking for support. If support slows down like it has with the economy, we'll just keep knocking on doors and trying to figure out the best way to take care of our service members. But, yes, support is desperately needed.
And the website address again?
I'm sorry?
The website address again.
The website, SemperFiFund.org.
There we go. Okay. Well, we're going to leave it at this. Angie McCrary is doing extraordinary work at the Semper Fi Fund, as is her team. Find out more about it at SemperFiFund.org. Check out this weekend's event honoring PFC Ryan Jerebeck and how you might help do similar kinds of things. in your community, in your company, in your neighborhood. And Angie, I just want to salute you all and thank you for what you're doing, and thanks to the troops that you're serving so admirably. Keep it up. And please come back to us. We'd like to keep updated as to how that is progressing, especially in these challenging times for philanthropy. I understand it all too well. Next up, we'll be talking with Waleed Fares. Get his situation report on the turbulent Middle East and what it might mean for us. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the craving for sweets. I totally lost the craving for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
This could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the country's truly outstanding authorities on matters involving the Middle East. You see him in Fox. You read his writings in all manner of places. And you perhaps have, if you're very, very astute, picked up at least one of his 10 outstanding books on various subjects of interest to us here at Secure Freedom Radio, including The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East. Hard to imagine a more topical or timely book than Waleed Fares' most recent. Waleed, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Let's start with developments in Libya, Waleed. The rebels, so-called, seem to be closing in on Tripoli, having cut off the lifelines to it and therefore presumably brought closer to hand the end of the Gaddafi regime. What's going on, as you see it, is in fact a final stage at hand, and if so, what comes next?
Well, Frank, basically what is correct in the assessment is on the ground. Militarily speaking, the rebels all combined, all these forces combined, have been able to make progress on the two fronts, the one which is the most important, the Western Front, getting closer to Tripoli from three axes, the south, the west, and the east. But still, they would need to work their way into Tripoli. That would be 90 kilometers or so for each one of these advances to get to the capital. And we know that large cities, if to resist, and that's a big if, can stand there for many months or many weeks at least. In the Eastern Front, basically, they have been able to secure most of Brega, which is a major city, and then from there on, they hope to have a ride all the way to Sirte in the middle of Libya. If all what I have covered is verified, it means that basically they have shifted the ground. It doesn't mean that they are about to seize Gaddafi's headquarters. One thing could change, you know, the whole equation if Gaddafi decides to leave. If he decides to leave in the next few days or months, weeks, then we're talking about the collapse of the regime.
Right. And obviously the role being played by NATO in terms of bombardment of Gaddafi troops' positions and so on may intensify the pressure on him to make that decision. Wally, but to come to the nub of it, I woke up this morning to hearing a report on National Public Radio of the rebels shouting Allahu Akbar as they were firing on the enemy's position. Do we know anything more about who these folks are and what will come to power in the event they succeed in ousting Gaddafi? Specifically, is it likely to bring about, as you describe in your book, the realization of freedom for the Libyan people?
Well, what is interesting about this question is that many people in Washington and many other European capitals have one thing in common when they talk about Libya. They say, we don't know much about the rebels. The rebels have two components. One are those who were with the regime before, former military, bureaucrats, diplomats. Those guys are largely secular. But then below them, at the level of the fighting force on the ground, and you are right to mention, the expression of these militias. We've seen it on Al Jazeera. We see it every day on other networks. We go on their website. And basically, these are Islamist militias. Almost we could call them jihadist militias. So the bottom line is going to be this. Once this combined force will get to Tripoli, will the regular new army of Libya, the one supported and will be supported by the West and funded by the West, disarm the Islamic militias? Well, that's the big question of the day. I move to say it's going to be difficult. Those militias, once they feel that they have acquired power and moved into a decision center, it's going to be difficult for them to accept being disarmed.
Yeah, well, and may well be in the position to have the stronger position, in fact, in terms of the support that they're likely receiving from their Islamist friends elsewhere in the region. Waleed Faris is our guest. He is the author of The Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East. He is a man who has brilliantly provided sort of color commentary on the Middle East at Fox News and periodically here, we're happy to say, at Secure Freedom Radio. Let's turn, if we may, Waleed, to Lebanon, your native land. There was a finding by a UN tribunal that I guess has now been formalized that indicates that Hezbollah individuals or associated individuals have been implicated in the assassination of the Prime Minister Hariri some years ago now. Does this materially alter things on the ground in Lebanon, and if so, in what ways?
Well, number one, yes, we now confirm that the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, working under the United Nations, has actually confirmed in its indictment that at least four senior members, officials of Hezbollah, were behind, according to the indictment, were behind the actual assassination of Hariri and of other Lebanese politicians. And the tribunal has informed some of the surviving politicians that this was the case. So now the case is open. Hezbollah is behind this. Obviously, on the ground, this is going to deepen the division between the now Hezbollah-controlled cabinet in Lebanon. Let's remind our listeners that Hezbollah seized the entire government a few weeks ago. They're in control of the Ministry of Defense, Security, Foreign Affairs, and the opposition known as the Cedars Revolution.
So does this translate into any threat to the regime, or do they effectively simply slough it off and continue with their effective intensifying control of the country?
Well, we've seen with previous decisions regarding Omar al-Bashir of Sudan that the decision is there by the International Criminal Court. However, it would need a Security Council resolution to be implemented. I don't see this happening for Lebanon, but the positive aspect is that Hezbollah lost the battle of hearts and minds, first of all in Lebanon, outside its own ranks, and second of all in the region. Many Arabs are now looking at Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, not just, as it used to claim, a liberation movement. So on the one hand, this will have an impact. On the other hand, it will all be determined by what's going to happen in Syria. If Syria Assad regime would collapse, this will be, this decision by the International Tribunal will be a probably the next stage in putting pressure on Hezbollah.
Yeah. Let's turn quickly to Syria. Waleed Faraz, the President of the United States has now added his voice to those who have called for Bashar Assad of Syria to step down. There are so-called sanctions that are apparently going to be in the offing here in the United States, though it's not entirely clear to what effect. There's a UN assessment team that's supposed to go in over the weekend to take a look at what the human rights conditions are in Syria. What's happening there, and where is it likely to lead?
Well, the beef of the situation in Syria is that the U.S. administration took a long time before moving on the issue. Meanwhile, what very few people have realized is happening, has happened, is that the regime took that time to eliminate many of the potential officers who could have risen against the regime much earlier. So the fact that we waited is not good. It's going to cost more to try to bring down that regime, to weaken that regime. The second point is that this time was given to the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, as was the case in Egypt, as is the case in Libya, to organize further, and that's something we need to address. And last, we need also the United Nations and the United States and the Western Alliance need to call directly on the Syrian armed command and forces to rise against their regime to have an effective change. Otherwise, it's going to be long, protracted, and bloody.
Yeah. We've got less than a minute. Waleed Faraz, quickly, on the prospects for the Muslim Brotherhood, you mentioned Egypt. Give us your latest reading on the likelihood that it will, in fact, wind up being the most important power within the new Egypt. And does this, again, come back to the thesis of your book, represented a step towards freedom for the region or not?
Well, in my book, I projected that once the authoritarian regimes are going to go down, they're going to be a race. It's not going to be like Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, whereby the communist goes down, Democrats will come in. In this case, the authoritarians like Mubarak, Ben Ali, Gaddafi, and even Assad will go down. There will be a fierce race between, on the one hand, the young element, female element, the minorities in those societies, unsupported by the international community, unrecognized, and on the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood and their Salafi allies, who unfortunately, again, have been seen and perceived by the administration and many other Europeans as potential partners. So if the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt are going to make progress in the next few months and years, it's not only because they are strong, it's because they have been considered, unfortunately, again, by the West as the partners, instead of really partnering with the democratic forces who are not organized, who are not funded yet. That's the essence of that race.
I fear we will be looking back on that as a strategic error of the first order. Waleed Faraz, as always, we appreciate your counsel on these matters. We look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, we have Colonel Ed Wallaby talking about a powerful new tool for our country in the war for the free world. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope and life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Ed Walby. He is a retired colonel in the United States Air Force. He is a man who has considerable experience as a pilot, including 4,500 flight hours in a variety of aircraft, not least 150 of them in the U-2 aircraft, a highly specialized intelligence aircraft that I'm sure we could spend easily the full segment talking about some of your experiences, Ed, in that connection. But welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. You're currently Director of Business Development for the HALE Systems Enterprise, the High Altitude Long Endurance Systems Enterprise, which features the Global Hawk, and we're very pleased to have you with us to talk a bit about this aircraft, an unmanned aircraft, and the contribution it's making to our national security. And welcome to Secure Freedom Radio for that purpose.
Well, I appreciate the chance to kind of set the record straight and talk about what Global Hawk does.
Well, let's do that. Tell us what it is, first of all, and what distinguishes it from other unmanned aerial vehicles, as they're called, in terms of capabilities and the kind of missions that it's asked to perform.
And just as you introduced me, you mentioned I had 150 U-2 hours. It's actually 150 hours in combat with U-2. And the reason why I point that out is that a great portion of my life was spent flying U-2 operations, very, very similar to what Global Hawk does now. In fact, Global Hawk is destined here to replace the U-2. What it does is high-altitude reconnaissance for very long distances and at a great length of time. U-2 restricted to 12 hours, based on the pilot inside the cockpit. Global Hawk now brings along with it 30-plus hours. In fact, it'll easily make it to 36 hours on a single mission. And what it does...
Allowing it essentially to hover where you want it to be to give you continuous surveillance on a battlefield or an intelligence target or something else, presumably outside of anti-aircraft missiles and range, right?
Correct. And at 60,000 feet, you're above the winds, you're above weather, you've got more freedom of movement, you're very efficient in fuel consumption, and your horizon is 300 miles away. You know, at sea level, horizon is like 12 miles, but at 60,000 feet, it's 300 miles. So if you have good sensors, you can see quite a distance, and you don't have to be over your target.
Right. The idea of having that kind of loiter capability obviously has applications both for battlefield situational awareness, as they say in the military, and for intelligence collection. Can you give us a sense of the kinds of missions that the Global Hawk has been performing? And one of the interesting things that I heard about it is that the current most up-to-date modern capable version, the Block 30, has been actually operationally utilized before it achieved what is called the initial operational capability certification. And you mentioned off air that that's been true of the program throughout its history. Tell us about that, because it really suggests that we're getting a lot of value for this program even before it's ostensibly ready for it.
Yeah, it's one of those few rare programs back in the early 2000s that was designated as a spiral development program. And what that meant was you build it, and as you build it, you begin to discover and employ it and use it in ways. You don't set it in concrete and decide that's the way you're going to use it, but you allow it to be used. But as it turns out, with the world situations as they are always cropped up even before we had planned to try them out. So the first deployment after 9/11 was we took the experimental aircraft overseas, discovered a lot of things about the flexibility of the system, and kind of wrote the book on how to use it. And then the subsequent versions that we're flying right now, Global Hawk, Block 30, is a fine example of that. Air Combat Command was ready to position them overseas, awaiting this IOC declaration, which in the acquisition world comes after a few, you know, you have to pass a test, you do this, you do that, the paperwork's done, and now you're IOC and you can be employed operationally. Well, back in March, we were sitting in Guam with three jets, we were sitting in Sigonella, Italy with three jets, and of course the big earthquake and tsunami in Japan. So within 20 hours the decision was made, the system's ready, we're waiting for some declarations and some paperwork, let's start using it. And and we ended up flying round the clock from Guam all the way up to Japan and nearly 24/7 coverage for about a month and a half.
In support of the rescue operations and sort of damage assessment, I assume.
Yeah, we carry three kinds of cameras, electro-optical, it's like a black and white still camera, an infrared, which is black and white, but it shows what's hot and what's not, and then a radar imaging camera. And believe it or not, all three of those were used quite extensively because of the devastation and because of the widespread damage and isolation of certain towns and villages. We were able to assist the Japanese government with pinpointing survivors, with assessing damage, observing the nuclear power plants. At one instance, they were up there searching an area where there was a hospital. Everyone was sure that the hospital was on commercial power. We shot a couple of images. When I say we, I mean the Air Force. A couple of images of the hospital, and found that the generators were red hot, meaning the generators were supplying power. They weren't on commercial power, and so that allowed the government to send the right people in to get them back up on commercial power, because you can't run forever on generator power. Little snippets and stories like that of the operation, but well over a month and a half of support to that operation with these Block 30s.
Wow. We're speaking with Ed Walby, retired colonel in the United States Air Force, highly decorated for his various contributions to our national security, including the Meritorious Service Medal, the Air Medal, the Legion of Merit, and the Bronze Star. Ed, one of the interesting things, I'm sure as a pilot you witnessed this firsthand, has been the Air Force's reluctance, storied reluctance in some cases, to have missions turned over to unpiloted vehicles, seemingly, at least in some cases, and in this one, in the case of the U-2, evidently, at the expense of having men in the cockpit, or women for that matter. Tell us about how this works operationally. You indicated that you benefited enormously from having a greater loiter time than you could if you had a man in the cockpit. But give us a larger sense of what it does in terms of a force multiplier to have this kind of capability available in an unmanned vehicle, and particularly if you could, in its applications in the military sphere as well.
Yeah, I'll talk in generalities about the Persian Gulf, just to keep it from being crossing over into some areas that we don't want to discuss in public. But essentially, a single Global Hawk can perform about three times the mission of a U-2 in terms of length of mission. We also carry all of our sensors simultaneously. So when we first deployed, so it's not true now, but when we first deployed to CENTCOM, we had three U-2s and two Global Hawks, but we only used one Global Hawk at a time because we only had enough spare parts for one in terms of maintenance. I had 25 people with me. The U-2 had almost 160 people with its deployed element. So you have 160 people you have to protect, 160 people you have to worry about, feed, they're away from their families, et cetera. On Global Hawk, the 25 people with me were mostly maintenance. All the pilots, except for a handful, were back home at Beale Air Force Base. And so the infrastructure that you'd normally carry with you can stay home because they're flying the mission. All we were doing was catching and launching the aircraft, making sure it was, you know, ready to fly in terms of maintenance, but 90% of the mission was flown from Beale. So you have pilots now who don't have to go overseas. They sleep at home. They live with their families. They work hard, no doubt. They work very hard. But allowing that force to stay mostly at home changes the whole dimension of how you employ these systems.
Yeah, a great story. Very quickly, I've only got about 15 seconds. How is it performing in terms of maintenance?
Actually, very, very well. It's about a sixth of the maintenance man hour that's required on the U-2. So its reliability since its IOT&E has gone way up. Using it, getting it in the hands of the folks who want to use it, they become very efficient at it. It's better than 95%.
Fabulous. Spiraling development, a success, using it to great effect for both civilian and military purposes. Ed Welby of Northrop Grumman's business development for the high-altitude, long-endurance systems known as Global Hawk. Congratulations. Thanks for coming on. I trust that this will be one of the programs and capabilities that is spared the kinds of budget cuts that we're discussing here at Secure Freedom Radio and trying to stave off. And thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform and now at Northrop Grumman. Come back to us again with the report soon, if you would.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The MetaSystem from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The MetaSystem also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the MetaSystem, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the MetaSystem to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The MetaSystem by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Real.
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, the National Security Editor of the Washington Times, a columnist who authors the highly regarded Inside the Ring column, and the author of numerous books, including most recently The Failure Factory, a man we turn to each week, and it's always a pleasure to do so. Bill, welcome back. Good to have you with us. You've been on vacation. We've missed you terribly, but glad to have you in the saddle again.
Good to be back. Good to be on the show.
Good. Let's start. Vice President Biden has been hanging with the communist Chinese recently, extracting from them apparently some seemingly rather upbeat assessments of the economic prospects for the United States. But it would seem at something of a price, Bill. The United States has backed away from support for Taiwan modernizing its air force. Tell us what's going on here and what the implications might be, most immediately for the Taiwanese, of course, but perhaps for our interests in the Western Pacific as well.
Sure. Well, first let me give a shout-out to the Hoyas basketball team, which beat up a bunch of Chinese military basketball players in a big brawl during the vice president's visit.
Yes, indeed. Go Hoyas. Hoya Saxa.
Yes. Yeah. The vice president is on a getting-to-know-you tour of China. In other words, he's out to schmooze the designated communist successor to Hu Jintao. That's Xi Jinping, the current vice president. And the trip is basically the Chinese are going to hammer the U.S. on its debt crisis and also, of course, Taiwan arms. The timing of the Biden trip to China coincides with the anniversary of the third communique, which is the most controversial of the three communiques that set out U.S.-China relations back in the 70s and 80s. And this 1982 communique is used by critics of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan to say that the communique says arms sales should decrease. Well, in fact, it also says, and it's made clear by the U.S. actions, that the U.S. has no intention of ending its arms sales to Taiwan. Of course, that's front and center in the relationship right now, as you have massive congressional support. I think it may be a bit of an exaggeration, but it's certainly clearly there's huge support for selling new F-16 jets to Taiwan, and yet in order not to offend the Chinese, the Obama administration is avoiding that and is refusing to sell these urgently needed jets.
Yeah. You mentioned in your Inside the Ring column, Bill, that this is not only very substantial support, but on both sides of the aisle for this transaction, and yet the administration is, it would seem, fulfilling the clear meaning, I guess, of the third communique, though not as it's been practiced heretofore, most notably by President Reagan. Where does this leave us, Bill, in terms of an important alliance relationship and the security of U.S. interests in the Western Pacific, do you think?
Well, it's very dangerous. I mean, going back to the Clinton administration, we had a situation where the imbalance in power between the mainland and the island across the 100-mile Taiwan Strait was growing. We're back to that situation today, where the Taiwan military's forces are becoming obsolete at a time when the Chinese buildup is massive. And you couple that with new aggressiveness and assertiveness on the part of the military that we've seen throughout East Asia, and you have a formula for instability. You know, it was Rumsfeld who said weakness is provocative, and clearly the growing weakness of the Taiwanese is going to provoke the Chinese to do something which could involve the U.S. in a conflict. We're basically obligated to prevent the forcible reunification of Taiwan by the mainland under the 79 Taiwan Relations Act.
Right. Bill, this is also happening, as you report in your Inside the Ring column, at a time when the United States Navy seems likely to shrink dramatically, thereby further exacerbating, really, the kinds of strategic dynamic that you've just described. Tell us what seems in prospect for the Navy, especially if some of the more draconian of the cuts that are now evidently in the offing were to eventuate.
Well, we know that the minimum of $400 billion in cuts over the next 10 years is likely to be doubled or even doubled and a half under the efforts by the Congress and the administration. I mean, defense is being cut mercilessly, and obviously internal documents that Rowan Scarborough, my colleague, obtained show that there's a shortage, that the Navy's not going to have enough ships under the current plan right now. And if they cut further, the likelihood of being able to maintain robust naval forces is very unlikely, and we're hearing even Leon Panetta this week, who came out and said he's very concerned about the hollowing out of the military under these proposed draconian defense cuts.
Bill, in those comments, Leon Panetta, the new Secretary of Defense, serving the Obama administration, of course, also made a reference to concerns about the volunteer army. I don't know how explicitly he described what he thought was on the line there, but is he in effect telegraphing that we may find ourselves having to go back to conscription?
Yeah, that's a good question. I could never see that happening under the left-wing Obama administration. And Panetta was categorical. I mean, he said hollowing out the force would terribly weaken our ability to respond to threats in the world, and it would break the faith with the troops and their families, and we have commitments. And he said a volunteer army is essential to our national defense. Any kind of cut would literally undercut our ability to put together the kind of strong national defense we have today. And I think that there are certainly people within the Obama administration that would like to do just that, and that's the real danger that we're facing with this current budget crunch.
Yeah, it is striking that we had many people, I think, expectingly on Panetta was going to get over to the Pentagon and, you know, bring sort of the green eye shade, former Office of Management and Budget director's, you know, role to that. And yet he evidently has been seized with the gravity of the situation that we're facing as a result of cuts that have already been taken, let alone those that are now, as I say, possibly in the works. Bill Gertz, one other element of this that is troubling is the extent to which we're seeing all of this play out at the same time that Russia is once again seemingly up to some of its old tricks under Vladimir Putin. And I tend to think that has something to do with Vladimir Putin's ambitions to be reelected as president of Russia and therefore sort of running on an anti-American platform. But tell us, your colleague Eli Lake at the Washington Times has been doing some important reporting on what Putin is up to and the Russians more generally. What's going on there, and how does that bear on what we've just been discussing?
Yes, this is a big story that is not getting the attention that it should, and that is the revanchism, the efforts by Vladimir Putin and his KGB cronies in power in Russia to really try to restore the old Soviet Union. I mean, that's really where they're going. And a fundamental element of that is the vehement anti-American sentiment that's growing. The latest was we had Putin calling the U.S. a parasite. But behind the scenes, we're seeing a rise in KGB-inspired direct and indirect action against diplomats in the U.S., a vast increase in Russian intelligence and dirty tricks activities both in the United States and abroad. And, you know, a lot of people are very alarmed about it. Unfortunately, again, the Obama administration has taken this appeasement approach that nothing the Russians do should rise to the level of even public criticism. And this is really an alarming situation, in my view.
Yeah, this is the so-called reset at work, very much a one-way reset. Bill, I think you said diplomats in the U.S. I think you meant diplomats in Russia,
yep.
Of course, and
yep.
It's really the sort of Cold War Moscow rules of yesteryear. And we appreciate, Bill, as always, your insights into these sorts of challenges that we're facing and the, I think, further underscoring that they constitute of the need not to let down our guard and not to fall prey to some of the foolish, I don't even think of it as pound, or penny wise pound foolish, I think it is penny stupid and pound reckless ideas that are now passing for national policy making when it comes to national security. Bill Gertz of the Washington Times, thanks again for joining us as always. It's great to talk with you. We'll do so again next week. I hope we'll be talking with all of you next week as well. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.